there, it's Tracy Tully, and you're listening to Tracy Tully Talks at bbsradio.com, the place to be right now, streaming live with another 60 minutes of thought-provoking topics, sharing with you conversations that are relevant today, tomorrow, and in the future. Join me each week on Thursday mornings at 10 a.m. Australian time, AEST, 5 p.m. Wednesday, PT, hello Los Angeles. If you missed the live show, jump onto your favorite podcasting platform and you'll find me on Tracy Tully Talks. We do have some adult language, so if you have some little ones around, pop on your earphones. Hello and welcome here in Australia. It is Thursday, the 31st of December, 2020, and it's Tracy Tully here speaking with you today, and I'm wishing you an Aussie Happy New Year. Wherever you are in the world, I hope you had a wonderful Christmas and were able to enjoy and relax with family and friends and eat some delicious food. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to introduce you to our speaker, Sean McBride. And Sean is an author of The Grey Man, and there's the book. We'll be talking about that later. And he's also an ex-Army commando, and he's done lots of other things, including going to the Antarctica. But we're going to hear all about that today. Hello and welcome, Sean.
Oh, hi, Tracy. Thanks for having me.
I love your background, and it looks very chilly there in Brisbane.
Yes, I know. I'm trying to create the mood.
I love it. I think it's a good idea, and I like the wind in the background, and it looks very cold, that's for sure.
Yes, well, it can be very cold in Antarctica.
So we're looking forward to talking today. And just for our listeners, Sean works in the Native Title branch here in the Queensland Government. He is the father of a beautiful daughter and husband to wife, Masao. And so we're going to talk today about Sean's journey and how he came to the point of going to the Antarctica. Sean was born in Bankstown, an inner suburb of Sydney, in 1959, and he had a lot of siblings. So he was one of six boys and one girl. His mother was a nurse and his father was a mechanic. So tell us about life growing up there in Bankstown in Sydney, Sean.
Well, we moved out of Bankstown pretty early on and went down to Wollongong. Yes. Which is where I basically grew up and spent a lot of my time. my family were pretty crazy, dysfunctional as a lot of families are, and I needed to escape them quite regularly. So I used to head off into the hills when I was about 15. I used to go solo camping by myself, and Wollongong was great for that. You could go up into the hills behind Wollongong, and there was miles and miles of reserved land, and yeah, it was great. So I used to just go off, camp out overnight, and try and learn as much about living off the land as I could, because, you know, for a long time in my life I was a survival instructor. So that's where that started from. And I used to sit up on a hillside and often think to myself, what am I going to do with my life at 15? And it was sort of staring me in the face, because I was already doing it. I was learning about survival, learning about wild foods, how to camp out, all that kind of thing. And, I was in Wollongong up until about the age of 24. And then I moved to the Blue Mountains for a few years, and then eventually headed overseas for a year or so, and then back here to Australia, to Brisbane. And I've been here for the last 20 years or so.
So you've settled down your roots there in Brisbane, in Queensland, in Australia. It's beautiful, beautiful state, lovely and warm. Here where I am right now, it's quite cool and it's been raining. We travelled, as you know, I spoke to you at 7 p.m. last night, and I was at Gundawindi, so we drove all the way up from Melbourne to Toowoomba here. It was a 16-hour trip, and it was very wet for most of the way. So we've been able to have a chat before we came on board. And I love your story. So when you left school, you went to the Army Reserve. Is that correct?
Yes, I did. I was a bit of a hippie in those days, I actually was only with, I joined the Special Forces, the Army Commandos at that time, the Reserves, and I was a bit of a hippie. So I pretty much, we kind of came to an agreement after about 3 months that it wasn't right for me, and I left. But I always regretted it. And so when I was about 30 years old, I actually went back, went through all the testing and whatever again, and spent another 5 years in the military, most of it in Special Forces, which was a great time. I mean, I loved it. It's boy's own adventure, really.
Yes, yes. And you talk about it in your book, The Grey Man, and in detail there, what you did and what happens in a unit like the commando, etc. And of course, these units are very much in the media right now, aren't they? In Australia, we've got the SAS and the commandos also sort of get a bit of a mention there, and there's a lot happening on there in the media.
All for the wrong reasons, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's good to hear you say that, because you know, everyone has an opinion about it, and being armed forces yourself, and myself coming from a background of armed forces. My father was in the RAAF, and my mother's father was in the army, and all his brothers, they all fought in the First World War. My father's in the Second World War in the Malaysian campaign. So we've got a lot of that sort of loyalty to the armed forces. And I myself are pretty disgusted with the fact that been allowed to be aired in the public arena. What are your thoughts about that, Sean?
Well, I guess I have a different view, and I'm glad that it's come out into the open. Unfortunately, I think it's going to be taken the wrong way, and people are going to blanket the military as being this, you know, bunch of nasty people that kill civilians, when in fact it was a small number of people that went off the reservation. And you know, I think it was when you have this strong element of secrecy that you have in Special Forces, that is a likely occurrence. And what we have to remember is that this was a small number of people. I mean, the SAS has perhaps 800 people in it, and we're talking about maybe 30 people who may be up on charges over these incidents. And they have tainted everyone else in the military, not just the SAS, but the rest of the military. And as you know, there are so many good people in the Australian military, and we do so much good in the places that we've been, that, you know, I think the book should be thrown at these people as an example to others. Not that they really need the example, because, you know, most of the people in the military are decent people. But these people thought that they could, under the guise of war, could get away with criminal acts, and it's just not on. We have to be better than the people that we fight, is my feeling.
And have you read the Brereton report?
No, I haven't yet. I've only seen excerpts from it, so I've kind of stayed away from it, because I don't really, in a way, you know, I've been out of Special Forces for a long time now, and I don't want to be have my memories of it soured by the activities of a few.
It's interesting, on my return journey from Melbourne, I stayed with a very dear friend of ours who's an ex-Vietnam vet and done two tours of duty, and has, as a result, suffered from quite significant wounds. We were talking about the topic, as you know I would, and I said to him, my concern is that we will see this witch hunt that we saw with the Vietnam war, and how you know, they weren't welcomed back, and they weren't they simply weren't treated the way they should have been as soldiers on their return to Australia. And I said to him, I really am concerned that people without the education and knowledge will start up a witch hunt without really knowing or understanding the background. As you know from your time in the service, unless you're there, you really don't know, nor can appreciate, nor understand the whole, you know, everything that happens in and around those situations. And I suppose, as you know, my background as a whistleblower, one of the biggest things I worry about is the lack of signed allegations, where someone will sign a stat deck and actually say they've seen A, B, C, and D, and as a witness. And we have a lot of people in the population who buys into what they read in the media, and that may not necessarily be correct because they may not have read the Brereton report right from the very top. So you've got people there slinging information around or opinion around without fact. And that's something that really, really concerns me. So it's good to hear your view of it. And I'll be doing a series on this actually in February, and I'll be interviewing a lot of both Vietnam vets and also former army guys, soldiers and women whom I had the honour of referring to the army as a school principal for my school. So it'll be interesting for me to see what I can hear from that in terms of that. But coming back to you, I see we're both dressed up today. So your outfit on, and tell us a little bit about your outfit.
Well, this is my Captain Antarctica outfit. And when I went to Antarctica, it had a major impact on me. And, you know, from my book, you know, that I was involved in the child rescue in the past. Well, that all came crashing down at one stage. It's a long story, but the end result was that I was in a fairly, you know, mild depression for a long period of time after that. And a friend of mine was a psychologist, and she gave me a glass jar, it was like a crystal type of thing. And she said, put into that the things that you want to do, like a bucket list, you know. And I'd read a book a few years back about Mawson, Sir Douglas Mawson, and his adventures in Antarctica. And he has an amazing survival adventure where he came back. He and two others went out, and the other two died on the trip, and he managed to get back. And it's an epic tale of survival. And that influenced me, and I decided that I wanted to know more about Antarctica and I wanted to go there. So in the meantime, I set up this Captain Antarctica site to basically inform people about Antarctica and what was going on there and the history, the environment, the whole, you know, everything about it. And it was a few years ago that I ended up thinking to myself, well, I better get down there. And this glass goblet thing that I had, the only thing I put in it as a bucket list was to go to Antarctica. And finally, I decided, well, now's the time. And so I actually signed up to do a postgraduate certificate in Antarctic studies at the University of Canterbury in Christchurch, New Zealand. And the beauty of that course was that part of the course involved a trip to Antarctica for a couple of weeks.
Wow.
And it went to the place where all my Antarctic heroes had started from, on the Ross Ice Shelf. And so we got down there, and what I realized was, you know, Antarctica, like much of the world, is under threat from everything from climate change to microplastics in the ocean, or plastics in general in the ocean, and the effect on the wildlife. Even Antarctica is not safe. Even with its remoteness, it's being affected by us. You know, they even find our chemicals in the flesh of penguins. So it's not untouched anymore. And it struck me that it really needs to be protected. But in order to protect it, people have to fall in love with it. And to fall in love with it, you need to know about it. And so I really basically do the whole Captain Antarctica thing as a, how would you say? What I found was that people relate to superheroes rather than just raw science. And so I've set up Captain Antarctica as this superhero protecting Antarctica. And at the same time, I gradually introduced people to the science about Antarctica, about what's happening with climate change, about the environment, the history, the wildlife, all that kind of thing, to encourage people to learn more and to get involved in its protection and to start looking at changing our behaviours and the way the world's going so that we can retain it for future generations. So that's basically, I suppose, in a nutshell, what Captain Antarctica is about. So in order to promote that, I give talks at libraries and different things, but I also have a Captain Antarctica website and a Facebook page and an Instagram account, and people can find out about Antarctica through those things.
And just for our listeners, I have the Facebook site right up in front of me at the moment, and I love reading Sean's Facebook site because Sean has very interesting posts with a lot of fascinating history. And one of the recent ones I was talking to you, Sean, about last night was on the 8th of December, and it was the legend Chuck Yeager, who was a test pilot who broke the sound barrier. And he passed away recently at the age of 97. I found that story absolutely fascinating.
Oh, right, right. But that was Chuck Yeager. I don't think he ever made it to Antarctica. I think that was more on my Facebook page.
Correct.
I guess that sort of ties in with my interest in aviation, as you know.
Yes, correct. And the two go together, don't they? Very much so. Your interest in aviation and the Antarctica, because that's where you're heading again. Is that correct?
Yes, that's my longer-term plan. I mean, I was supposed to be lecturing on ships in Antarctica right now, except COVID kind of destroyed that plan, and it may not happen next year either. But my longer term plan is to actually in order to promote renewables, is to fly an aircraft from Scott Base in Antarctica to the South Pole, an electric aircraft. Now, they're not capable of doing that at the moment. You know, the battery technology is not there yet. The engines, the electric motors can do it, but the battery storage is not good enough. But every week there's a new breakthrough, there's a new improvement, there's a new efficiency in these batteries. So I'm looking at, you know, probably a 6-year, 7-year plan, and maybe it won't come together. But, you know, it really comes down to you've got to have some goals in life or some challenge to overcome. And so I have the plane, a Whitman W8 Tailwind, which is a beautiful aircraft designed in 1953 and quite fast even now for its age. And we'll see where that goes. You know, I have to convert it to electric, and in the meantime, the technology may catch up. So we'll see.
I see, you know, obviously I've been following you with great interest in terms of your journey flying and where are right now today. So you recently got an endorsement. Would you like to tell our listeners about that endorsement that you've just got recently?
Well, I've been a slow learner pilot. You know, it's been taking a while to get my license, but I got my license earlier this year, and I've been planning on taking my wife and friends up, but I needed to get a passenger endorsement, which I only just got last week. And so now I can take people up with me. The next step is I haven't actually flown my plane yet because it's a bit tricky and I need to have an instructor with me. And they couldn't fly with me because while I was a student, because my plane doesn't have brakes on the passenger side where the instructor would sit. It has rudder pedals, but it doesn't have brakes. And so legally they couldn't come along. But now, I don't know why that changes, but now, because I have my license, they can actually fly with me. So sometime in the next couple of weeks, I'll be taking my plane up for the first time. And that should be interesting because at the moment I'm flying bush planes and they do about, 80 or 90 knots, which would be about, 100 kilometers or so. No, that's not right. About 160 kilometres, maybe. And anyway, my plane actually does cruises at 220 kilometers per hour. So it's a very fast plane. And so everyone describes it as quite slippery. So that's why I need the instructor with me to get the hang of it to start off with, and then I'll be happily flying around by myself soon. Oh, but I have a few years to get better at all this, you know.
And that's the thing. I mean, as you said, you have to have the challenge, don't you? You have to have that bucket list thing that you aim for. And because it gives you a purpose, doesn't it, in life? We have different purposes, obviously. You know, we have our children and our families, and you have a wife and your work. But the passion has to be nurtured as well, doesn't it? Otherwise, life is a bit boring, don't you think?
Oh, for sure. You know, and I think, you know, this is something I've been harping on for a while with people, you know, especially men, because a lot of men are a bit lost nowadays. But what I've been saying to people is that really men and women as well, but I think more strongly men, need purpose, a tribe, and adventure in their lives. And the modern world doesn't necessarily give them that unless they step out of their comfort zone and try and embrace it, you know. And so, you know, I was at a very low point in my life about 15 years ago, I suppose. And then the idea just came into my head to rescue these children in Thailand. My daughter was 5 years old at that time. And I remember just leaning against the wall of the room, looking at her while she was sleeping, and thinking to myself, oh, this voice just came to my head and said there are children her age being abused in Southeast Asia. And I was quite surprised, and I thought, I wonder where that came from. And I remember thinking to myself, well, if I could do something about it, I would. But at the time, I was broke, I was out of work, I was depressed. And I'd left the army about 2 years before, I think it was. And they owed me a chunk of money, which they kept losing the paperwork. And about two weeks after this experience of leaning against the wall and thinking, oh, yes, I'd do something about this if I could, they put $15,000 in my bank account. So I took that as a sign, and I went off to Southeast Asia and rescued five children on a promise to my daughter from brothels. And I came back and then realized that there was a lot more work to do. And luckily, I gave a talk at a Rotary Club, and a couple of men came up to me from there, Russell Hawkswood and Jeff McGlashan, and they offered to help. And so we basically formed an organization called The Grey Man, which that book you showed earlier was about. And we basically ran rescue operations, and I got together people from ex-military, ex-special forces, ex-police, and civilians to basically volunteer to come to Thailand and rescue kids. And we ended up, you know, as a completely volunteer part-time organization. And over the years, we rescued 176 kids from brothels and prevented the trafficking of about another 600 through other activities that we were doing. We also helped out the hill tribes. We set up all sorts of programs. We sent hundreds of kids to school. So we did some great work up there. And that the interesting thing about that was that at that time when I was feeling so depressed and down, about three weeks, a month into doing that, I was up in a hill tribe village in a bamboo hut, and I was woke up and I realized I was happy.
Yeah.
And it was because I was helping other people. And I think people don't realize how gratifying it can be if you're doing something that helps other people and it takes you away from yourself. So from that point on, you know, I was incredibly busy with it. And for the next 7 years, you know, we rescued these kids and it was a wonderful time in my life. But, you know, they bandied this word around now, fake news. And we were the victims of fake news before it was ever a popular term. And what happened was that we rescued these 26 kids, I think it was, up in the north of Thailand. And in the process, we stepped on a lot of toes. People people with vested interests up there, you know, and there's a lot of corruption in Thailand. And they started a campaign against us, claiming that we had faked the rescue to raise money, you know, for ourselves, I suppose. But what they didn't realize was that all our money was funneled through Rotary. And so we could only get the money for Rotary if we justified what we wanted to use it for. And it was all, you know, audited and all that kind of stuff. But of course, the media doesn't care about the fine detail. And they put a front page of the Weekend Australian, they put an article saying that we had allegedly faked the rescue and we were under investigation by the federal police. Neither of which was true, but that doesn't matter, you know. It did damage. And so, you know, from that point on, I stepped down at that time to protect the organisation because the people in Thailand seemed to want to get rid of me, basically. And then I handed it over to someone else, and then, you know, they stopped doing rescues, and it kind of continued on for about 2 years. I'd left them with a lot of money in the bank from donations from the Australian public, which we used to keep children going to school and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But the new director basically stopped the rescues. And so it became a shadow of its former self, and eventually when they ran out of money, they closed it down. And that's where, you know, I went into this second phase of depression where I thought, you know, you can't change other people. You can only change yourself. And so rallying against, you know, the corruption in the media and all the rest of it, even though I did try for a while, I looked at suing them. I looked at getting the ombudsman people and all sorts of things going on. And in the end, I realized I couldn't do anything much about it. And so the only thing I could do was to change myself and my own attitude. So I ended up becoming a Buddhist monk, which seems like a strange option, I suppose. But at the time, it made perfect sense, and still does, you know, because really the whole aim of, say, Zen Buddhism, which is what I was where my interest was that, you know, that an individual can achieve enlightenment and perfect themselves, I suppose, and not get caught up in all the rubbish that we see in the world today. So from there, you know, that my life started to change a lot, and then, you know, Antarctica kind of came up, and then I kind of slotted in that, and that's where my passion and purpose lies now. And so that's where we are.
It's I understand totally, and maybe some listeners will also understand exactly what Sean is saying in terms of being hung out to dry because of media.
Well, you know very well yourself, Tracy. I mean, we are birds of a feather.
Yeah, that's why I brought up that, you know, the armed forces scenario that's happening in Australia at the moment, because I feel for anyone that has their wings clipped and cannot fight back and has to sit there and endure. And it's not just the person like you, myself, and these SAS guys. It's not that we have to sit back and endure. It's just that we know exactly what happened. We're the only ones that know exactly what happened. We're the only ones that were there that knows what was going on in here, here. And it's too easy and it's too fast for people to just grab a baton and run with it. And we have in Australia, particularly in Australia, you know, the tall poppy syndrome.
Oh, absolutely.
That's specific to Australia mainly. You won't find that. Probably in New Zealand you will, but you won't find it in too many other countries, the UK. But it's shocking here in Australia. And it's the tall poppy syndrome for our listeners is where they'll tear down anyone who is achieving. And it's like, you know, take them off their perch sort of thing.
Absolutely.
And what you went through, you know, from your aspect and from the fact that you have a family, and that was for me, the biggest issue for me and why I wrote my book was a legacy for my children and for their children, so that the real truth came out. And isn't it interesting? Because I've had a wonderful, wonderful outcome since I've written my book. Because in the back of my book is a call for a class action and a call to change the Public Service Act. And not long ago, the last parliamentary session before our Queensland elections, guess what they did?
Did they change it?
Changing the Public Service Act, the Public Service Act, or PSA, as I call it, which is extremely corrupt and enables people to do and say whatever they want without furnishing any evidence at all. Just say something and the government accepts it and they'll slaughter you, slaughter your career, slaughter your family, in my case, my partner's career, and our children. And it went on and on and on and on. And some of the things they did to our children were just shocking.
And aided and abetted by the media, you know, that never give you the full story.
I was a little bit lucky with the media in that when our ethical standards unit, the two guys in our ethical standards unit in the Queensland Department of Education, they tried to mince me up and they tried to give the story to a political journalist at the Courier Mail. And he actually said no. Exactly right. And that's why it's important for me to say that, because how lucky was I that his ethics were at that level to say no, no. And I was very fortunate, because what they wanted printed was pure garbage. And they had no evidence or anything. There wasn't even an allegation made. They were making up their own. And they were just running. It was just like, because they have the freedom to do it.
There's no payback for, you know, getting it wrong, really.
And there's nothing I could do other than sit there and watch it unfold and watch, you know, how bad it is. And it was so bad for our son that he left Australia at the age of 15 and he went to Nebraska in America.
Wow.
And went there for almost 7 months to get away and from bullying. And good on him, because it was the best thing he did. And he did it all on his own. So, you know, the resilience that we learn from these sorts of things, there's always a plus in these sorts of things as well as the negative. And you've moved on and can do. And you're not afraid to talk about it.
No. I think you're right, especially about the resilience. You get to a point and you suddenly realize that life goes on. You know, the fact that they've just embarrassed and lied about you on the front page of the newspaper, in the scheme of things, you know, like people often say, it's, you know, it's tomorrow's fish and chip paper.
Absolutely.
Except now with the internet, you know, if you look up my name associated with Greyman, you see all the rubbish continually replayed. I actually just submitted a information to that media inquiry into Australia.
Yes.
Regarding my experiences with what happened and some suggestions about how they could improve it in the future. It's not to say that the media are all bad. It's just that you have lazy journalists and you have very good journalists, you know, and sometimes you have vested interests and people with an ideology that they want to push across, and it's not a fair-handed appraisal of what's actually happened. And you can tell them one thing and then they'll twist it to give a completely different slant on it, which is what happened with some of our stuff, you know. But here we are, you know, 7 years later, most people don't even remember it. So, you know, life has moved on and I'm quite happy doing things to do with Antarctica.
Yeah.
Which is working out well. You know? And here you are, you know, few years later.
That's correct. And it's important, I think, because for me, it took me a long time to accept it all, but my decision was to write my book. And at that time, it was a terribly, terribly difficult thing to do. And I had to rewrite it 3 times to ensure the solicitor was happy with it, because I wanted to name and shame everyone, literally.
Yeah, for sure.
Because I haven't signed. I haven't signed anything to say that I can't. And I wrote to the department, said, guess what, when I resigned from the Department of Education, I said, guess what I'm going to do now?
I love your spirit.
Now, there's no way you can zip me up now. And, you know, and they're atrocious things, and they know it too. And obviously, you know, at the back of my book is a call to a class action, and I am getting people who want to be part of that class action, and so they should.
Yeah, like, absolutely. Yeah. That's wonderful.
It is. And I was very fortunate, like yourself. I was invited by the head of the CCC here in Australia, a wonderful man, Mr. McSporran. I was invited to do the same as you, to meet and write down my recommendations on what should happen. And it's simple for me. The simple thing is, if you make an allegation against anyone, you sign a stat deck. You sign a stat debt, because if you say something against me and you haven't got any evidence, I'll shoot the socks off it. You watch. Not a problem.
You know, and here, you know, a stat deck is worth something. Unfortunately, in Thailand, it's not worth very much.
Right. And that's the thing. Yeah, you went and did what you thought was right. You had a terrific organisation, and you know within yourself, and so did they, that everything was above board. Likewise, you know, some of the allegations against me, I was in a charity organisation. Everything was above board. And not only was it so above board that I saw what was coming, I went one step ahead and I got an extra auditors. And then I had audited yeah. them. Yeah. So the Department of Education fell flat on their face because they just went on a whim of what people were saying, and these people were minority groups that had a lot of pull, and it was all political, etc. And it didn't work. Didn't work. It worked at the time, but it doesn't work now.
It worked. So, well, you know, the patron of our charity was Justice McMurdo, a federal court judge, and she said to me once, you know, she said, we're talking about the corruption in other countries and that. She said, well, you know, the corruption is here as well. And and in order to prevent it, it takes eternal vigilance, because it's always popping up. Doesn't matter where you are. I mean, we've got checks and balances here, but people manage to still get past them, unfortunately. Oh,
and they always will. And that's exactly right. Doesn't matter how ruthless you are with your structures, like I was very fortunate, extremely fortunate that the accountant actually said, you know, you need to employ these other people above me and above them, because you've got trouble, Tracy. These people are trouble. And thank goodness for that conversation that day, because they were hell-bent on having their field day with me and making up some great stuff. But I'm actually wearing a dress, and it's a Torah Athena dress from Egypt. So my bucket list was, I went to Egypt in March this year, and I had a wonderful time, and it was something I had wanted to do my whole life, and it was quite mind-blowing for me, and it was just phenomenal, and it certainly changed the way I thought about everything and how I was able to look at everything in my past. And I did a speech. I went in as a political activist. I spoke at a conference with 3,000 women. I went in as a political activist, and I actually spoke about the corruption in the Queensland Department of Education in Australia. And quite a lot of people that came up to me afterwards from Egypt, and they said, we can't believe that Australia has that corruption. We thought it only happened here in Egypt.
Everywhere.
Yeah. And I proudly wear this today, the same thing. So it's very significant. This beautiful outfit there, and for a local outfit that's made, and it really is a beautiful. You can see
it looks
all the work.
Great, yeah. I often say to people, you know, about this bucket list thing, is what is your Antarctica? What is it that will make you, you know, change your life, make life sing again? And for you, it's like you could be saying, what is your Egypt? Because Egypt was the big change for you. I think we all have these things, you know, but we don't actively pursue them unless we step outside of our comfort zone. So that was a big leap for you, because that was at the time of coronavirus, and I think it was going to get cancelled, wasn't it?
Yeah, I had like days to make up my mind. Did I take the risk and go and not know what could happen, or did I stay? And I really thought that I should probably, and I'm a huge risk taker, as you know, I thought for once in my life, maybe I better not. Maybe I better be careful. And then my sister came up to me, my little sister, my elder sister, and they said, do it. Just do it. And worry about it later. And I was really, really pleased. So I flew out in the last plane. And that in itself was a funny story. Flew out the last plane, and I was so pleased I did it. So very pleased.
And no regrets, really, I bet.
It was fabulous, and I'd do it again. And that's what we can tell people from here today, to encourage people to contact the likes of you and I, listen to these podcasts and these web TV radio broadcasts, and hear what other people are doing, other normal, everyday people like you and I, who are crushing our goals and going out there and having a go, despite those naysayers and those I won't even name them because it would be rude. Than BBS radio would appreciate, but rise above them.
Yeah, and it all just comes from fear, doesn't it? I mean, fear of change, and people see other people doing stuff, and there's a certain element of jealousy and all that there. And you know, you and I have talked about this before about how we see ourselves, and you know, we were tossing around the ideas like coaches and mentors and all that kind of thing. And I suppose it maybe it sounds a little bit presumptuous, but I actually see myself as an inspirer, as I think you are too, whether we acknowledge that or not. And people have often come back up to me and said, you know, you've inspired me to go out and follow what it is that I want to do. And the thing that often happens is, you know, you see some of these goal setting courses that people do, and they say, okay, now the first thing you do is you write down your goal, and then you write down all the things that will get in the way of your goal. And I say, screw that. That's just dumb. You know, just go and do it, and all those things will pop up. You know yourself, all those things will get in the way. You don't even know what those things are going to be at this stage. And the thing is to just keep your eye on the goal, whatever it might be. And it's got to be something that, you know, makes you want to sing, you know, that you feel something about, you know, it's got to be big enough that it's a bit bigger than you, and you can't be sure that you'll actually achieve it. If it was easy, everyone would do it. So it's got to be a little bit hard.
I agree. And I think, what are we waiting for? Why are we waiting all the time? And it's fear of failure. So it's not only fear, it's fear of failure, of being judged. That's the big part, isn't it? Or fear that you're not good enough. And this holds back a lot of people. I have a little mantra. I like to move from resilience to resistance. I'll resist. I'll actually resist. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll push back so hard that I'll push over. Because you know, when you've done everything in your life and you've helped people and you've been slaughtered like you and I, then there's nothing to lose. There's absolutely nothing to lose.
That's so true. That's so true. And you know, it was a bit of a death wish for me when I went to Thailand, that I thought I wouldn't make it back from there because of the people I was going to be dealing with and whatever.
Yeah.
And that acceptance that, you know, you're probably going to die. And the reality is we are going to die. So if you accept that reality, then what can touch you? Nothing. Huh? Because what's the worst that can happen? Well, you could die. Well, that's going to happen anyway at some point in the future. And so that actually gave me a lot of strength to just push on and keep going.
I agree, and I love your stories, and I'd like to interview you again later. And Sean, I'd like to formally invite you in February or March. We're doing an international speaking summit for women, and I'd like you to speak to our women about your journey. I'd love you to share it. Obviously, we're doing a women's speaking summit, but we're going to have some gentlemen there. And Nick Cree has also agreed.
Right. Yeah, I like Nick, great guy.
Yeah, and it's great.
I'd be happy to. Tracy, thank you for the offer.
That's wonderful. That'd be really good. And I know we're going to be winding down shortly, so I'm watching the time here. And just a couple of other questions. You've started your big bucket list, and it is a big bucket list, and it's a bucket. Obviously, it's got no bottom, because as you said, your journey with your plane, your electric plane, is in which you're adapting yourself, is going to take some years, and you're not afraid of that time frame. You're rolling with it because you're going to find lots of opportunities in that as you go, aren't you?
Oh, I am, and this comes back to something that's really important. You know, people get fixated on the goal. And it may be that this goal never eventuates. It may be that it all becomes too hard basket. You know, that's possible. It may be that, you know, I'm prevented because of COVID or something like that, you know. But what I realized through my life is, you know, when I got my university degree, when I got my Green Beret in the Commandos, when I got to the tracker school in America, which was a long time project and all this, when I got there and actually achieved the goal, there was a feeling of flatness after it.
What next?
And I think that's quite common. Yeah, and that's it. Because the goal, people get fixated on the goal, and the goal is really not where the joy is. The joy is in the journey.
Absolutely. And
you know yourself, you know, that the journey can be up and down and all over the place, but it's much more interesting than living a life that doesn't have a goal in it. You have to have that goal to go for, but you don't want to lose sight of the journey to get to that goal, because when you get that goal, it's probably not going to be all it's cracked up to be, you know? And I found this time and time again. And something else that I found, I don't know if you know Tony Hsieh. He was a multi-millionaire in America, and he died just recently in a house fire. But he set up a company called Zappos, which sells shoes online. And yeah. I think he sold it to Google or whatever for, like, you know, $1 billion or something. But he came up with these four aspects of happiness, which I think really ring true, and they have for me. And those four things were, number one, you have to have a sense of control in your life, you know, or a perception of control. Really, we're not that much in control of our lives. We think we are, but things can come along like COVID and just knock us for six, right? But perception of control is important. Then after that, you need the perception of progress, as if you're moving towards something, as if you're heading somewhere. You're not just a hamster on a wheel, just in the one spot, just treading water. The third thing is a circle of friends, you know, a group, a tribe, whatever it might be that you want to call it. Because otherwise, but you know, we are herd animals in a way. And and we're not, you know, we're not meant to be alone. And it's the friendships in life that actually give this life its joy. And the fourth thing is something, a belief in something bigger than you. Now, that can be a religious belief, a spiritual belief. It can be a belief that you can achieve something bigger than you are aware of or you think you can do. And if the more of those four things that you can fit in your life, the happier you will be. I have found myself, you know, if I've only got one of them, I'm a little bit happy. If I've got four of them, I'm very happy. And at the moment, I've got four of them, so I'm pretty damn happy.
Yeah.
And everyone can do that.
Yeah, I hear you. And it's good that you mentioned him. Tony Hsieh, was it?
Yeah, Hsieh. He was Chinese, I think, or American Chinese.
Hsieh.
And he wrote a book called Delivering Happiness or something like that. I've forgotten the name of it. Now, the unfortunate thing was, in the last few months of his life, he missed out on number three. He moved away from his friends, and he started paying people to come and join him in this venture that he had. Like, it was a trailer park, like an upmarket trailer park type of thing. And he started paying people twice their normal wage to come and be entrepreneurs and all this kind of thing. So he surrounded himself with a bunch of people who were yes men. And then he ended up spiraling down into drugs and all kinds of stuff, you know. And so I think his four goals or his four aspects of happiness are true, but he actually didn't follow them to the extent that, you know, would have kept him happy, unfortunately. But I think there's something in that for everyone.
There is. I can certainly hear it. And you talked about, you know, us inspiring other people. And I like to acknowledge the people that inspire me too. And I've got a lady at the moment, and I've interviewed her. Her name is Danielle Stearman. And boy, has she inspired me. Danielle has, you can see her on YouTube, her interviews with me. And we had a conversation just before Christmas, and she ignited this passion in me, which is phenomenal. And I haven't stopped thinking around this project that I'm going to do. She's going to guide me. And it's not many people like that that you come across that are happy to give you everything. You know, they're happy to give you all their knowledge, and they share, and there's no conditions.
I love that. Rare, very rare.
Very, very rare. D Stephen is very, very rare, and a phenomenal lady, a real gift to the world. And I don't think she knows it, but I certainly do. And I look forward to basically being mentored by her, because I see her as that. And there's, you know, these wonderful people that come across your lives who you don't have to pay them anything, and they're just happy to share with you, mentoring you, aren't they?
Well, and there's another interesting point, because you're basically a mentor yourself, but it just goes to show that even mentors have mentors.
Absolutely. You have to keep that growth, don't you? Keep that growth going.
You have to
be mixing with like-minded people. And the minute the minute you stop mixing with like-minded people, you're going to have a problem like Tony experienced.
Yes, exactly. And I'm finding now that my new group of mentors are in the aviation world, and I'm learning a lot from a whole group of new people. So, yeah, we always need mentors.
I agree. And you might like to share now with our listeners where they can find you. So you've got Sean McBride, and for our listeners, that's Sean, S-E-A-N, McBride, capital M, lowercase c, capital B-R-I-D-E. Now tell our listeners where else they can find you with your Captain America Facebook and other social media.
Okay, so with Captain Antarctica, I have a Facebook page, which is just Captain Antarctica. And I have a website, which is www.captainantarctica.com.au, which has lots of stories about Antarctica on it. And I'm also on Instagram. If you just look up Captain Antarctica on Instagram, I can never figure out how you tell people what the Instagram thing is. So, yeah,
we'll
just Captain Antarctica.
If you we'll find it. That boy and send it to you. Our lovely girls, Jen and Ria, will do that for you. So they're the girls
who are conversing with you, yes? Oh, yeah. And look, I'm not selling anything on Captain Antarctica. Not that it would matter if I did, but it's really an educational – they're all educational sites to let people know about Antarctica and hopefully turn people onto Antarctica the way I've been turned onto it and how it's changed my life. And I hope more people get to see it at some time in their life, because it is a life-changing experience.
It's actually one of my bucket lists I've been with Mawson. My father gave me a book years and years and years and years ago. Dad was actually applied for a job to work there as a doctor, and mum, it was going to be a long time and he wouldn't see mum. That and Tibet. I wanted to go with him to Tibet, but it ended up with the issues were that you've got no medical other than yourself. There's no one else to, you wouldn't want to be, they have taken out their appendix, haven't they?
Yeah, in those days they had to take their appendix out if they're going to be a doctor at a...
That was a pretty big story.
Well, there was a Russian doctor who actually operated on himself to remove his appendix in Antarctica with the help of two of the guys that were technicians down there, and achieved it successfully. But you don't really want to do that.
No. They were quasi surgeons and anaesthetists, weren't they? So they jumped into a put a different hat on, well and truly, and that was the sort of thing, because Dad had his appendix, and they said he had to have his appendix out. Yep. He had to have his appendix out before he could go to the Antarctica. And he just said, no, I don't need to do that.
Good on him. I don't think it's so necessary now. You know, some places still might require it, but I think, especially in winter, it's very difficult to get to Antarctica. It's very rare to be able to get in there. So you could be in a situation where it could kill you if you had your appendix. Yeah.
Absolutely could and would. If they even looked like they were going to blow up and erupt, and you had no way of doing anything about it, then yes, that there's only one way, and that's downhill with that sort of thing. So you've got your website. So it's www.captainantarctica.com.au. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes. And there's the Facebook page. They just look up Captain Antarctica. They'll find me on Facebook.
Good. And also your personal Facebook page. So if anyone wants to get on Facebook, they can send you a message via Messenger too.
Oh, yeah, that's true too. But I'm trying to give myself more time now. So I've still got Facebook, but I've taken Facebook off my phone because I'm spending far too much time on it when I should be reading more about Antarctica or flying my plane. So hopefully that will give me a few hours extra a day.
Yes. And I think
they can contact me.
Yeah, with the social media, you really have to go in and get out, don't you? You can't hover around.
You can't hover. You just become, you know, I think what it does, it triggers that serotonin in your brain, and you get these kind of little bursts of like, oh, joy, 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 you know, as you go through pictures or whatever. So, yeah. And then, of course, there's all the arguments you can get into, and all the conspiracies and the fake news, and too much.
No,
it's my New Year's resolution.
Oh, is it? I love the history that you share, and please don't stop sharing that history. I just love those stories. I love reading about them, and the information that you shared about women aviators in the past, they've been absolutely phenomenal. And some of those Russian pilots, Air Force pilots, unbelievable.
There should be. Look, you know, women are unsung heroes of aviation. There are so many women who are so gutsy and did so many brilliant things. And all we ever hear about is Amelia Earhart, who was gutsy. You know, she was brilliant. But there are so many others. And, you know, some of them were flying to Australia from England in the 1920s and 30s, you know, like amazing stuff.
Oh, and American female pilots. I mean, I never get sick of those stories. And there's just so many of them. They're fabulous, fabulous. You know, on LinkedIn you can see and read about even the current ones that are happening today, the graduates, et cetera. I love listening to that. And aviation is close to my heart.
Your father was a pilot, that's right.
My father was an RAAF, plus he was a pilot as well, and plus he was a doctor. And so he married those two careers together. And he became a flying doctor, and that was just yet another fabulous opportunity for him and for me, because I got to fly a lot with him, and he actually saved my life because my appendix was just about to burst, and he had to do a very long trip, a milk run, so to speak, very long trip to fly and get me and bring me back. He just got me in the nick of time. They were able to open me up and drag out my appendix, keep me alive. But so I got to see Dad quite a few times as a doctor, and I got to be his quite a few times. So it was a lovely experience. And of course mum was there as well, side by side, being an air hostess. So now, to get back to you, thank you very much, Sean, for sharing your information. We'd love to have you back on again. I do invite you to come and speak with us in March for our International Speakers Summit. And it's mainly for women, but we obviously are going to invite men as well to speak, because we'd like to share their particular stories. And we know that we can probably help you as a group in terms of what you might be looking for sponsorship or support in some way that as a group we could provide for you.
I'd be more than happy to, Tracy. Thank you for the offer.
Thank you. All right, then. So we have to go now. So I'd like to thank all our listeners for listening to Sean and I chat today. And thank you for listening to another 60 minutes of Tracy Tully Talks on BBS Radio. And you can find us on bbsradio.com/Tracy Tully Talks. No E's in anywhere there. And if you scroll down to the bottom of that page, and you can leave a message for me and I can respond to you. So for everyone here listening today, thank you for joining us, and we wish you a happy new year and a wonderful 2021. Thanks. Cheers.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to another 60 minutes of inspiring talking points on Tracy Tully Talks, brought to you by bbsradio.com. Tune in every Thursday morning at 10 a.m. Australian time, AEST, and 5 p.m. PT time in America. Leave me a message on my website at www.bbsradio.com/Tracy Tully Talks. If you're interested in lifting the profile, presence, and profit of your business, sponsorship opportunities are available. Until next Thursday, it's goodbye from me.